Congratulations!
You're listening to Congratulations Pine Tree, the Bay's number one arts and culture podcast, with me, Kate Rhodes.
And me, Maysoon Waswas.
That's us trying to change it up a little bit. You know, things get a little calcified the longer you do these, and sometimes you gotta throw a wrench in it and see what happens. This is the last episode of the podcast.
Aww.
Because this week, we interviewed my favorite art historian. No shade to all the other art historians that I also love. I love many art historians.
Well, but this is your favorite art historian.
This one,
that is fine.
Blows all the other ones out of the water.
Straight out of the ocean. Directly out of the sea.
And that would be Professor Dr.
Nice.
Julia Bryan Wilson.
Ooh.
Bum, can bum, I bum, tell bum, a bum. Really weird story?
Of course you can. When have I is ever it, said no?
I may have to edit this out because this is so ridiculous.
Just say it. I want to hear
but
it.
But as you know, Maysoon, I was... So Julia Bryan Wilson starts the interview right off with this story about this eagle that escaped the Menlo Park or the Palo Alto Zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And after the interview, I was very moved by this story. And I almost went myself to find the fucking eagle.
Tell us more.
I am doing a residency at Recology, so I have access to all this garbage in San Francisco. And I had a plan. I did a lot of research on falconry, and particularly this eagle. I watched videos of them doing their, you know, where they have it go and fly around and then come back to their leather gauntlet, the falconer's glove.
Yeah.
And so I was going to go through the garbage and make a leather gauntlet, and I got locks at the bagel store.
It's amazing. You really took it up a notch.
To summon the eagle, and I found out the last place it was seen, and I was like at Recology, which is right by a Caltrain station, and I was going to take Caltrain down to the South Bay and find this fucking eagle. And thank God I would check Twitter and found out that they found it. So point is, the eagle was found. And I'm glad I didn't die because I had visions of the eagle ripping my jugular vein with its talons.
Like so, missing the landing spot and just like putting it onto your neck.
They have knives on their fingers.
Huge blades.
Long story short, they did find the eagle that you're about to hear about in the interview.
Immediately.
And all is right with the world. You know, the sun's coming up, rainbows, all that shit, and it's all going to be fine, and that's what I think. What do you think, Maysoon?
I feel relieved that they found the eagle. It made me smile. I feel good that not only am I happy, but another person is happy because of that. Many people are impacted by this eagle having been found.
I mean, Twitter was...
blown up?
Yes.
Yeah, cool.
People were very concerned, especially in the area.
Yeah.
So I feel like there are just infinite possibilities and life is born anew every day.
It's perfect.
So here's an interview for you, listener. And I hope you get as much out of it as we did, which is quite a lot. Here in beautiful UC Berkeley at Doe Library, talking to art historian Julia Bryan Wilson. So just to get right down to it, let's hear your bird story.
So on Monday, I was invited to give a talk at Stanford University, and I decided to spend the night with my partner. So we went down there a little bit early, and we were pulling into the parking lot of the hotel, and we were going to the convenience store to buy some potato chips. And my partner said, "Oh, what is that?" And just looked up, and just maybe 15 feet above us was a bald eagle.
What?
Circling the parking lot in Palo Alto, and it was very exhilarating. We felt like, what is this beautiful, you know, rare creature that we beheld? And then we went into the convenience store, we told everybody about it, and people came rushing out with their cell phone cameras, and it felt like this moment of collective awe. And then just 10 minutes ago, I'm telling you the anecdote in part because it's framing my mood right now, which might affect my interview a little bit. So my partner just sent me a link to a story that actually was from the Palo Alto Zoo, an escaped 27-year-old bald eagle named Sequoia, who's been missing since Monday. That was, we saw her, the eagle, right as she was making her escape, because it was like right at the moment she flew away from this demonstration. But she's actually injured and cannot forage for herself. And we thought we were seeing this, you know, beautiful vision of like freedom and liberation. And it turns out, because we did see some weird trailing little, what looked like tethers from the legs. And, but we didn't know what to make of that. But now it's really clear that, you know, and they haven't been able to find her, and her tracking device is getting weaker and weaker. And it's been now a couple of days, you know, and they're really afraid that, I don't know, apparently she often has flown away and then come back, but never, she's never been gone this long.
This long. That's sad.
What does that mean for America?
I know. Well, God, I so am, it's terrifying to imagine. It is terrifying to, and of course, eagles are not only freedom, but also fascism. They have served dual purpose in the historical symbolism, you know, throughout the ages. So I think it's, oh, I shiver to think, but I just feel, for me, it's been so curdled, you know, what I thought was just this incredibly beautiful moment that I kept thinking about, actually, for the past few days as something really astonishing and even magical, and now it's very depressing that it was this paralyzed, injured, and caged animal that now may never be able to fend for itself. And what that means for America, I can't speculate, but definitely I feel, you know, that we're in a moment of great crisis and fear. And it's, to me, a very awful, I'm in a very pessimistic mood about the state of the nation.
I think it's going to be okay.
You do? Why?
They're going to find
Wait,
it.
Really?
Oh, the eagle, not America.
No.
I'm like, wow, I want to hear about that too.
I think it's going to be okay. So you're from Houston, Texas, which is the fourth most populous city in the United States.
Right. Actually, I just was there, just gave a talk there last weekend, and everyone was all abuzz about the fact that it will soon overtake Chicago to become the third most populous city in the United States.
Yeah. Do you ever say y'all?
I do frequently say y'all. Yeah, I do. Although I was kind of humiliated out of my accent when I went to college. People made fun of me because I did have a Texan accent that was much stronger than it is. I still have a little bit around the edges. You can hear it, but it was pretty pronounced. Yeah, and people made fun of me. Like, I pronounced G-E-N-D-E-R, an important word in my world as a feminist, gender.
That's fine.
I wish I had held on to it, but I think I got a little bit, you know, I assimilated, basically.
Yeah.
At Swarthmore.
Correct. Yeah.
Snobs.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, I don't have a lot of nostalgia for that place.
Do you ever feel weird in that kind of way, being at UC Berkeley? Do you ever worry that someone's just going to hit you with their Nobel Prize?
Never. I've never been a fear. I have a lot of fears, anxieties, worries, and concerns about being on this campus, but never that someone's going to hit me with their Nobel Prize. Is a Nobel Prize even something to hit someone with? Does it come, is there a statuette? I've never seen. Yeah, what is the, what physical form does it take?
I always imagined it as a medal.
Oh, there's a medal.
Like I think so.
Yeah. Right. Okay, but not like on a...
But if it was swinging, if they were walking vigorously, right? It's not a concern, I would say. That it's not a present concern, like weighing at the forefront of my mind right now.
You're also a queer person.
Yeah.
How was that in Houston? Wasn't so great in Ohio.
Yeah, actually, that's a great question. I came out of the closet when I was 15 in Houston, Texas, you know, in the 80s, so it was not bad. And in fact, it was a very queer city historically, I think. And I went to a high school that was public arts high school where a lot of people were queer, and it wasn't a big deal. Yeah, so I feel like, but at the same time, people were being murdered, you know, there was queer bashings that happened in this neighborhood where my high school was, and there was a very big HIV crisis in the city, as with many, of course, many cities in this country, but it was very palpable there. So I don't know, it was mixed, but it did, I felt like there were conditions of possibility that were pretty open. And then later in college, I actually, for one summer, worked at a lesbian bookstore that was owned by a person who became the mayor, the first openly lesbian mayor of a major city, Anissa Parker. She co-owned this bookstore called Inklings. Yeah. And it was like Ani DiFranco all the time as a soundtrack. And I can still to this day, if someone puts it on, I was just at a dinner party and someone was like, "Oh, Ani, haven't heard Ani in a while." And I was like, "Take the Ani off." It just reminds me too much of that summer, you know? Yeah. So anyway, there was, it could sustain things like lesbian bookstores where people would come to buy their freedom rings and their Texas shaped rainbow flags and their Ruby Fruit Jungle, you know? It's pretty amazing. Yeah.
That's awesome.
I know. That's one of my most treasured summertime jobs, for sure.
I always think whenever I meet queer people in the Bay Area that aren't from here, that they are, you know, leaving their oppressive hometown.
Not at all. Not in this case. Yeah. And there's so many stories to be told. You know, I think San Francisco was a mecca for so many people, and it was a place of escape or longing or fantasy, a space of otherness away from, you know, homophobic circumstances or whatever. But so many other places have also been interestingly supportive enclaves, you know, or at least tolerable, survivable, you know? Yeah.
So some of your research has been around, I have a background in dance or contemporary dance, especially. And so some of your research has been around really important, interesting dancers, mm-hmm. Simone Forti and Yvonne Rainer. I'm just curious to know what your relationship with dance is or how you got into that.
Right. Very accidentally, in a way. Or not accidentally, I think I came to especially those figures through my interest in minimal sculpture, which has been very, has been of very important research interest for me since I can remember. And they are, of course, so interestingly interwoven with that scene and the minimal dance and minimal sculpture. There's many interrelationships there that are important to map and to understand. I think and then Yvonne Rainer was my colleague at UC Irvine, which was great. And she happened to be teaching a class that just said in the record Trio A. And I didn't know what that meant, you know, in the course catalog. So I was like, I'll show up and I'll observe and see. Because I thought she was going to give like a series of lectures about it or something. Right. But then she was like, now we're learning Trio A. And I just thought, I have the time. You know, I don't have anything to do during this time slot. So I learned it from her, which was a really incredible, immersive experience. And I was super clueless and bad at it and totally I'm not a dancer. I don't come from that. That's not my way into it is from, oh, and then I was a ballerina. You know, I was always a really awkward kid who had no physical grace whatsoever. So learning it was really super hard and really filled with effort, and filled with incredible, for me, that was an extremely fulfilling pedagogical experience.
Yeah. I think in the essay that you wrote about that, isn't there a point where Yvonne Rainer asks you if you can even run?
Yes. Oh, she was so critical and harsh. I mean, I did everything wrong. I think there were, how many of us were there total? 6 or 7? Anyway, I was by far the worst person, you know, so struggling. And it was humiliating. It's good to be, sometimes it's really refreshing to be the worst, you know, like I'm setting the bar really low and that everyone else can relax. You know, because like, you know, yeah, because you're not the worst. I'm the same at karaoke. I'm like, I've just made everyone really comfortable. You know, you're welcome because my version was so bad.
I want to go out with you for karaoke next time. Yeah.
What's your favorite karaoke song to sing?
Oh, I really love the Laverne and Shirley theme song. It's so great. Yeah. So that one is like my old standby.
Is there an artist or a work of art that you've changed your mind about?
Sure. Well, I remember seeing when I was a first year graduate student, or maybe a second year, but I was very early in getting my PhD here at UC Berkeley, and someone came to give a talk, and it was a woman art historian. I'm not going to name her name. And it was about Carl Andre, and it was about the question of horizontality in his work, and really a formal reading. It was very beautiful and elegant and respectful and really thinking about the formal qualities of his work. And I was livid. I was seething in my seat because at that point in my reckoning with Carl Andre, you should not talk about him. Or if you talked about him, you should talk about him as a criminal, you know, as a murderer, as, you know, or at least compromised by the death of his wife Anna Mendieta. And I just couldn't believe, I thought it was so irresponsible that she would be talking especially about horizontality, you know, this very fraught term given that Anna Mendieta was that the way that she died and was very much about horizontality in the end. And I was really, really angry, you know, just so agitated. And then, you know, very much to my surprise, I end up writing a dissertation that has a whole chapter about Carl Andre and is not anything to do with the death of Ana Mendieta. It takes place way before that they even met, and really actually coming to have a profound respect for the work itself. You know, a really meaningful engagement with the work at an intellectual level and at a on every level, you know, that work is very powerful to me. And I still can't, you know, I can't necessarily separate those things. What I think, you know, how I understand the circumstances of his life and the circumstances of her death. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I would see them in the audience necessarily anymore, you know, with that kind of this incredibly righteous indignation about, you know, because I really thought, like, it's unjust of you to even speak of him. That in my mind, it was like, there should just be a moratorium, you know, like Carl Andre should not be spoken of in the halls of the Academy. And I just don't, I have a more complex understanding now of that than I did then.
Do you feel that way about any other artists now still?
Like the sense that why would we even talk about him?
Yeah.
No, I mean, there's artists who I just don't care about, you know, like who I just think are, their work is insignificant or I don't like it or, you know, I won't teach it because to me it just will not stand the test of time and I'm very opinionated about that. But not in the terms of like there should be a political blackout, you know, like we should not give this person any attention because they don't deserve it for reasons of, you know, circumstances, of biographical circumstances, I guess. I don't think that I do feel that way. But there's people whose work I think is bad or ugly or silly or trivial. Yeah. And those people I don't talk about.
What's up with craft?
Mm-hmm.
And queer craft?
Mm-hmm.
How can I start getting into the queer craft world?
I think you can just declare yourself part of it.
I'd have to probably learn a skill.
Maybe. I think that can be one of the queer things you do with it. It's like, I'm part of queer craft and I'd have nothing to do with, but I've never learned a single thing. I don't know how to like sew a stitch. I couldn't like, you know, whittle a piece of wood. I have nothing. That would be an amazing queer act of craft, you know, absolutely about refusal and negation. That would be, I think I encourage you to do that.
Thank you. That's a great one. I could make yarn balls.
Just like,
yeah. People are doing that. I mean, that's enough. There's this whole, you know, kind of para movement called sloppy craft where just anything goes, really. So it should feel like a world of possibility for you.
Do you count that in craft? Like, would you be into that?
I don't police the boundaries. Yeah. I had a friend, though, who is part of the craft world who told me she had this, what she thought was a great idea for her next series of photographs, which was photographs of her kittens playing with yarn. And I said, you just cannot do that. I don't think it's a good idea. I think it's a really, really bad idea. She goes, no, but they're like drawing in space with the yarn. And I was like, it will just look like posters of kittens playing with yarn. Like, I don't care how much you dignify it or have your conceptual apparatus around it. It will be kittens playing with yarn. Yeah. I think I did dissuade her in the end.
Is it ever hard being friends with artists? When you're like,
when you're opinionated, yeah.
Well, and you're like writing for Art Forum and like.
Yeah, there is, sometimes it is awkward, I have to say. And sometimes I do feel like I'm not always sure when an artist wants to be my friend, if there is some other.
What the motive is.
Yeah. Ulterior motive.
I really have a lot of great artist friends and I have made friends because I have written about them, and I think that is like a wonderful way to be in conversation. And my work has really changed because of my artist friends, and I'm really indebted to them. And I feel like those are very productive conversations. But so it's just every so often, you know, just every so often I realize like, oh, I thought that person, or sometimes I'm like, oh, well, that person, oh, I'm going on a date. This happened a while ago when I was single. I was like, oh, I'm going on a date, having brunch with this cool artist. And then I was like, oh, this person is, you know, this is a promotional stop on their circuit. Like, this isn't some deeper connection. So that's disappointing.
It's weird that they wouldn't just approach you in a professional way versus.
But, you know, that's also really, you know, that can also be really tricky, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, would you write about me? Or that somebody's saying something like that? Sometimes that can be good and honest.
Just,
and
like,
sometimes.
Having to do a studio visit and kind of leave it more open ended. Yeah. Like, I just wanted to introduce you to my work and maybe you write about it, maybe you don't, but now you know about it, kind of a thing.
Right. Yeah. I think sometimes there's tricky dynamics, but I would say overwhelmingly, I love having artists in my life, and I feel like it's one of the best things about being a contemporary art historian and critic is getting to meet artists, for sure.
I wanted to quickly circle back to craft, because Kate and I often ask people in the Bay Area about when CCA dropped the craft.
I think they must rue the day they did that, because they did it, and then basically, you know, just right after that, this incredibly expensive rebranding and, you know, hurt a lot of people's feelings. And it was a big turning away from their whole history and what had been really core, central to their mission. And then, you know, obviously they did a lot of focus groups. I'm assuming that it was in a very expensive, elaborate process to completely change their name. And then, you know, craft is ascendant just basically seconds after they do that, yeah. And becomes really trendy, yeah. And becomes really like another good catchword that isn't no longer cast in the shadows. So I think it was just, in my opinion, it was a big misstep, you know, badly timed.
I feel like I know so many art historians who become curators or work in museums, mm-hmm. and I'm just curious to know, like, sort of what your process mm-hmm. in making that decision to stay in academia.
Oh, right.
Primarily, I guess, but you are.
No, it never felt so much like a decision. I didn't apply for curatorial jobs. I could have. I guess I have always really loved to teach. That's just a thing I've always, I mean, when I was a kid, that was always what I wanted to be. Like, and you can find like quizzes from when I'm 8 years old, like, what do you want to be when you grow up? And it's always as a teacher, you know? So I've always, that's always been my primary mode of identification, I guess. So, and with curating, I guess you can sometimes do that, mm-hmm. but, and actually I'm just recently was invited to curate something, which I never have been, it's very rare in my work, you know, I haven't been asked. I think I would have done it earlier had the opportunity arisen, but I'm co-curating a show about this woman, Cecilia Vicuña, who I've written about, that's going to be in New Orleans in 2017. And it's super exciting.
Are you also going to, like, write the essay?
I am going to do an interview with her. I have a whole chapter about her in the book that's forthcoming about textiles, so... But I will be interviewing her, and she's a great talker. She's also a poet. She's really known mostly as a poet.
Where is she from?
She's from originally from Chile, but she lives in New York now. Okay. She splits her time, actually, between Chile and New York.
Cool. Mm-hmm. Do you speak Spanish?
I do, yeah. I mean, I would have to say I read Spanish and that my speaking Spanish is very rusty at this point. Yeah, so it's not like I could just like plunge into a perfectly fluent conversation. But I did learn it, and I spent a whole semester in Chile when I was in college. I spent a semester abroad in 1994 in Santiago.
My brother's a Spanish teacher, and I had him tell me how to say, "We're here in the office of Julia Bryan Wilson, and I'll be conducting this interview in Spanish." But I forgot the entire thing.
Come on.
Come on.
I forgot it, but I can say, "Mis manos están aquí."
That's a, when does that come up? When is that a helpful phrase for you? I'm curious. In what context is that like the crucial phrase you need to pull out of your pocket?
I don't know. I guess if I was getting arrested in a Spanish speaking country.
But you could just do the gesture, like, here are my hands. It's interesting to think about how that would come in handy. Handy. I hate puns, actually. I'm like against puns.
Wow, that's what? Fascinating. Why?
You can't be against puns.
I know. I just said that to be polemical.
Oh, okay.
But often they're grating, I would say. Don't you think? Like, don't you think in like 80s academic titles, you know, when they're like the punning crazy titles with the slashes and the parentheses and, you know, it just can be too much.
Your partner, aforementioned, is also a professor here at Cal.
Yes, that's correct.
Mel Chin.
Correct, yes.
Not in your department.
No, in the Gender and Women's Studies department, yeah.
Do you have symposia in your home?
Oh, yeah. Well, Mel and I were talking about something. I don't remember what, but something, just chit-chat, we thought, you know. And Mel's brother kind of was in earshot and said, "Do you guys talk like this all the time?
I love it."
Yeah. So, no, I mean, a lot of our conversation revolves around our cat, you know. He is really a focus of a lot of speculation and projection, you know. So that, I would say, like, if you were to do the pie chart of what we talk about, he is disproportionately represented on that pie chart. But then we do talk about, you know, intellectual stuff. But it's not a symposium every night over dinner. Definitely not.
I love it. We also talk about our cats a lot at home.
So do we.
Oh, yeah. How can you not? They're fascinating. You should see my cell phone photos, too.
It's Are like, they full of cats?
Oh, it's like cat, cat, cat. You're scrolling down, cat, cat, cat. It's like 80% cat in there. Yeah. But he does cute. And I mean, I told a friend recently that probably I take 15 to 20 photos of him every day. And she was shocked. And I said, well, he does 15 to 20 incredibly cute photogenic things every day. So yeah, it would be least. Irresponsible of me not to capture those. Yeah, at least. At least. I mean, he can just shift, you know, and then got to capture that.
I wish this was on video. Okay, you were on a debate. I forget what that was.
Okay, right. This is probably Institutions by Artists in Vancouver.
Where you kicked everyone's ass so bad.
Actually, your team kicked everyone's ass.
Yeah, your team was on point.
Yeah, watched that recently. I was very impressed by everyone.
Good. Or, I mean, yeah.
Sam Gould was so bad.
I have to say, I don't think you got your full word in about the term art workers.
And yeah, when you were calling him out.
And I was like, we need to ask Julia about, like, what, you know, what that was.
Or if you wanted to complete the statement that he interrupted.
Right. Yes, well, definitely. I will say Sam Gould was a last minute substitution, so it's not entirely fair.
Well, he does say that many times.
Yes. Right. You know, I have not revisited that moment for a while, so I don't remember the exact thing that
he kept referring to himself as an art worker, and you asked him why, because he kept saying it, and he was like, well, you wrote a whole book about it,
right.
And well, you were like, fuck yeah, I did.
Right. Well, I think if I can recall, I think the issue at what we were debating was something to do with professionalism.
Yeah, should artists professionalize?
Right. Which I think is not a great question, actually, because
said that it was a false binary.
I think it is a false binary. But I think he was trying to mobilize this term of being an art worker to claim for himself that he was not professional or a professional, because he was counteracting work, you know, being a worker with being, quote, a professional. And I think that, you know, one of the lessons that I learned in writing my book, Art Workers, is that that term is so vexed, it is so contradictory, and it has never been stable, and it has never really actually made a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. And it's not a very popular thing to say, especially among artists, which is to say maybe art is not art is a specialized activity, but it isn't necessarily work, and you cannot necessarily claim yourself as a worker in solidarity, you know, with a specific class formation that you don't actually have anything in common with.
And that maybe it's not popular with artists and not popular with workers.
Yes, right. Well, definitely. Exactly. Yeah. So I think I was trying to put a little bit more nuance on that, on his phrase, than he was willing to admit.
And that really got his goat. But then I think Tanya Bergara jumped in and was like, shut him up, basically.
I wish that, you know what was great about, I mean, that debate was such a setup, as these things always are. And then, you know, that was a lot of work for us, actually. And it did spend a lot of time. And then afterwards, everyone was like, that was really fun. And I thought, here we are for entertainment or something. And I think those were really serious issues. And it was really a very serious set of conversations, you know, but in the circumstances of the conference, everyone just thought that it was like wildly entertaining.
But I think that's because the teams were so different as far as how prepared you were. Mm-hmm. You know, like your team all had notes, had a Skype meeting where their team had like, you know, a scrap paper from the hotel, which is fine. But it just seemed, I think that's why it became sort of funny, because there was
it's really hard
to sort of hear legitimacy on their side to some degree. Yeah. I mean,
you know, we got the chance to choose which side we wanted to be on. And I had met with Jeff Dirksen, and I somehow had this chance encounter in Germany where we realized we were going to be at this conference, and we had both been asked to participate. And we were like, well, which side should we pick? And we thought, let's pick the counterintuitive side, because it will be more interesting. You know, why don't we argue for the yes side, just because obviously everyone is going to think the answer is no. And again, that's why it's not a good question, because it is a yes or no answer. But so let's challenge ourselves, you know, and see what we can come up with if we decide to take the counter-orthodox viewpoint here. And I'm so glad that we did that. I think it was really a different, you know, kind of forced us to reevaluate and really question the premises of the question.
I think it's also entertaining because of how hardcore you guys kicked the other team's ass.
Okay.
This actually brings me to a question that was sent in by a listener when we said that we would be interviewing you. They chose to remain anonymous. Their question was, what are your thoughts on artists being pitched as cultural entrepreneurs or trying to convince leaders in business, tech, venture capital, and accelerators that artists are innovators and that they should help artists take their work to scale?
I mean, I think that we are seeing the incredible expansion of the term creativity to many different spheres, including to tech spheres and business spheres. And now everything is kind of under the umbrella of the creative. And I think it is often used in quite troubling ways, you know, because it is about a kind of colonization of truly experimental cultural production that is critical, you know? I mean, I think we have just lost the sense that one of the things that art is good at is being a space of negation, you know, and being a space of critique and being a space of withdrawal or refusal or failure, you know, just all of the, it's become so affirmative. Mm-hmm. And I think that, oh, we're supposed to grease the wheels, you know, that business is going to grease the wheels for artists to, what is this, say, scale up their practice or whatever. I mean, in some ways, I never want to begrudge anyone making a living for what they do. And I'm always happy to see artists get paid and happy to see people thrive and make a living, you know? Why would anyone resent that? But I don't think, I mean, I do think there are a lot of cozy relations, you know, extra cozy relations, especially in the Bay Area, between sort of tech companies and quote-unquote creative industries that feel really disrespectful of the fundamentally critical role that art has to play.
There was a interview conversation with you and Mel Chin.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Was that the Brooklyn Rail? Mm-hmm. Doesn't matter. Where you talked about wishing that people in academic lectures, when they ask questions, would actually ask real questions and not just use it as like a platform to show how smart they are. I was wondering, what's the worst question, in quotes, that you've ever been asked, in quotes, in a Q&A?
There are so many examples, unfortunately. I wish there was just one, but I think it is very common that someone will raise their hand and say things like, why aren't you doing what I would do if I was working on this material? You know, basically, it's like the gist of it. You know, how come you haven't thought about all these things that you're not interested in thinking about? So that's like a whole genre right there. That's like a major genre of an academic question. I once gave a talk at the Clark Art Institute where the very first question, a woman raised her hand. I pointed to her and she said, I totally disagree with everything you just said.
Oh, wow.
And there was no question. It was just a frank assertion of her complete rejection of my entire argument. And apparently Mel was in the audience and said that this woman had been shaking her head vigorously no the whole time. Yeah. So that didn't feel that great for sure.
That would hurt my feelings.
What did you do? Were you just like, thanks for your opinion.
Yeah. Next question. Yeah. Next question. Basically. Yeah. You kind of have to have thick skin in this business.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
This is sort of a weird one, but a number of people I know, artists, have coined you as sort of a rock star art historian.
Everyone thinks that.
What? It's fine. I'm sure most of your students are also are very inspired by you. And I was going to just turn that around. Initially, I was going to ask you what that feels like, but then I decided that that was silly. And I wanted to ask you, who were your rock star influences, maybe?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, yeah, I don't know. That phrase is odd, obviously, and feels weird. But I'm glad you turned it into a different direction. So let's see. Right. Well, you know, one of my big heroes is Richard Meier, who now is my friend, and who I just have absolute respect for. And he's a wonderful, wonderful thinker and scholar. And just today I taught one of his articles, which I do almost every class I teach. And he has just been a big inspiration for me and did kind of loom larger than life before I met him, you know, as someone who seemed just so kind of, wow, incredible and sparkly and, you know, untouchable or something. And now he's, you know, a palpable human as we all are, etc. And I still have those people, you know, I still have people who to me are kind of, I just can't believe that I'm coexisting with them on this planet at the same moment, you know? Yeah. I mean, not necessarily art historians, but people like Prince, you know?
Prince, who's playing in Oakland.
I know. I can't go. I know.
It's so
I know.
It was so
I know.
In the first, like, 3 minutes.
I know. We tried. Yeah. 7 o'clock and 10 o'clock. Yes, I know. We tried for the 7 because at this point I'm too old. But for a 10 o'clock show. But very sad. Very sad. Did you guys see his passport photo?
No.
Yes.
Wait, what?
What?
What is it?
It's just phenomenal. It's like a fashion glamour shot.
God, you know, as he is. Basically, yeah. And but it's his passport photo, you know? And he looks unchanged. He's amazing.
He is amazing. I'm also a big fan.
But he is literally a rock star. Richard Beyer is definitely not, you know, is not literally a rock star, but in my mind, was a rock star. Yeah. And still is.
That's what I mean.
Still is. Yeah. Yeah. Douglas Crimp, that's another rock star, you know?
Have you hung out with him?
I have, yeah. Wow. And actually, he's coming to give a talk in Berkeley sometime in the fall.
Could you make any comments on the term phallogocentrism?
Oh, boy. Okay, we have basically 3 minutes left until Mel comes to pick me up. Phallogocentrism. Well, what could I say there? That does feel, it feels not so fully pertinent anymore, I would say. It's not really a criticism. I mean, that was a criticism that was leveled with a lot of portent back in the day. Like, if you said that, that was serious. You know, you were really, like, taking someone down when you put that on the table. And it's just not a phrase that I feel like is kind of has the same gravitas anymore. People don't really take it seriously. I think it's a useful term. I have to say, I think it's a useful term. Absolutely.
I tried to bring it up at a talk the other night just to see if anybody else knew what it meant, and they didn't, but they loved it.
Yeah, good. You're reviving it. Keep going. I would say, how about in every lecture you see now, you raise a question about it?
Oh, yes.
You know, and just kind of just keep the spirit alive. Yeah, I think, you know, that was a helpful, it was a very helpful term for me as coming into my kind of feminist academic self.
We would like to just name off some artists and cultural things and see if you like or don't like them.
All right.
Jeff Koons.
Pause. Long, extended, it's pregnant silence. It's a little harder than, I mean, I would have to say, you know, ambivalent. Let's put that.
Oh, that's an option.
Okay.
Marina Abramović.
Like.
Dale Chihuly.
Oh, boy. Dislike.
Barry McGee.
Like.
Cindy Sherman's clown series.
Love? What? Yeah. Love.
Did you see that Bjork show at MoMA?
Yes, ambivalent.
Because was that at the same time as Yoko?
It was. That was an unfortunate pairing, I think.
Are you familiar with Family Circus?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Right. I'm going to go with like on that one. Yeah.
That's another surprise.
Controversially, I'm going to go with like.
The Rococo.
Oh, like. Nothing wrong with that.
I hate the Rococo. I hate it. Coloring books for adults.
I haven't formed an opinion about that.
Marlene Dumas.
Like.
Chris Burden's videos from the 1970s.
Like.
Okay, there's an overpass in Berkeley that's got these giant public sculptures with people protesting.
Oh my God, those are my most detested pieces of public sculpture in the history of the world. I think they are an atrocity. Now I'm going to burn a bunch of bridges locally, but I think those are awful. And in fact, I start muttering about them as we approach, you know, and then I crescendo into like, it's over University Avenue. And then I crescendo into my anger and my vitriol as we pass under the bridge. And then it finally fades. And it's like this very predictable arc of my anger and dissatisfaction at what a waste of a commission and what a very pathetic memorialization to the free speech movement. With those spindly legs, that part is so unresolved. Right?
Absolutely. Whoa. Couldn't agree more.
God damn it, I need to see it.
Oh, you've seen it a million times.
I'm sure you have.
Overlooked it.
You've seen it a million times.
Alberto Giacometti.
Like.
Both the figurative and surrealist incarnation.
Sure. Nothing not to like there.
Have you seen this one video on the internet of a human cat where he sings a song that goes, meow, meow, I am a cat?
No, but that sounds fine.
I'll send you it. Yeah. Also, Carol Walker.
Like.
And comic books.
Like.
Fair enough. Mm-hmm. Fair, firm, but fair. Thank you so much for meeting with us today. We can stop doing the podcast now because this is the only reason we started doing it. And as always, congratulations.
Soon. soon, have you heard?
About what?
That listeners can give us feedback at 419-351-6606. You can text or call that number 24/7. You can email us, congratulationspinetree@gmail.com, or you can tweet us at Pine Tree Podcast.
And you know what, listener? We're going to keep you guys posted on who we're interviewing next, because we did actually get a listener sent in a question for one of our recent interviewees.
Yep, you heard that one
great.
Today.
Yeah.
We really got to end on, like, the amazing.
Why don't you just, like, have an aria playing or something? Just throw an aria on. Goes look up the San Francisco fucking symphony.
From the bridge.
To that other bridge, you know, the one.
To the island in between. This has been Congratulations, Pine Tree.